The opinions expressed on the following program do not necessarily reflect the views of KTXT, its management, Texas Tech University, or any living person. You're listening to Anthony Pipes Hall and Kelly Dr. K. Caulfield, and this is the Devil's Advocate.
Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth.
Hey everybody, and welcome to the Devil's Advocate on KTXT The Raider 88.1. Tony here with Dr. K in the studio.
Hey gang, how are you? Coming to you live from the College of Media and Communication at Texas Tech University.
We're joined by a few guests here in the studio today. It's going to actually be a packed show. We're going to do very little talking for once.
Oh, this is fantastic. The audience is going to like it. We're going to like it. It's a win-win.
Yeah, so we've got Senator Erica Allen from the Student Government Association of Texas Tech University with us. She brought a guest who declined to be on the air today. You know, well, I'm going to out you. We also have Pete Bruton, a faculty instructor here in the college. He's one of the old newspaper-style journalists, right?
I wish they'd quit referring to us as old. Professor Bruton is
legendary
investigative. The reason he lives in West Texas is because they threw him out of Houston.
Yeah, they ran him out of town, pitchforks and everything. But he teaches us all here how to be very skeptical about everything. So that's how I got a lot of my good habits.
We will hear from him about a very interesting topic that we're going to share. I just want to tease you with it. There was a change in journalism from on high, from one of the agencies that really opines on the practice of journalism, and we brought him in for his expertise on that change.
And he is an expert.
I'm sure we'll disagree, and we're counting on Professor Bruton to sort of take the middle ground as a good journalist would. And
good luck with that.
Settle the fray with us. He's already openly laughing, so this is going to be really fun. You want to stick around for that. But first, we always talk politics, as you know, on the show. This week, we have local politics, and we're going to start talking about that. Yeah, very local.
In your own backyard.
Across the building local. So, exactly. So Erica joins us. Erica also is the Rules and Administration Committee Chair and the Honors College Senator. So, thank you for joining. You've been involved with SCGA for quite a while, haven't you?
Yes, I just finished my fourth year.
Speaking of old, old soul, all right.
Well, we're just going to throw it out there.
Now can I stick my neck out and say this may have been the most interesting year of your four to serve on the Student Senate?
This one was definitely my most involved year for sure.
Okay, yeah, it was intriguing, I know, all through fall semester, and we had a little fun at your expense with that. We were hoping everybody had a sense of humor. Anthony openly teased me about my poor attendance here at the radio show, and so it was an interesting year.
Last semester was full of jokes,
definitely. I'll be the first to agree on that.
So there was a let me find the original. There was an editorial that ran in a local news outlet on I guess it was published late in March.
March 24.
And it ruffled some feathers in a couple of quarters around this college especially, but also around campus.
Absolutely.
And was highly critical of the way some things were being done at student government. And and you had a very specific irritating retort to this person, because there was one thing that they admitted in this editorial especially that you took umbrage with.
Yes.
And so what was that? Do you want to tell us about it?
I see no problem with criticizing a government, offering opinions and critiques.
Good, because
that's
why you're here.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
That's why I'm here, you know. But I have a major problem if you don't participate in that government. If you forfeit, you know, the opportunity to change the government by voting in elections, which the author of this article did not and openly admits that he's never voted in an election before, then I think that you surrender all rights to criticize a government, especially as harshly as was done in the article.
Yeah, some pretty specific, some names, some people were named, although we're not quite sure who was named,
because
the names weren't all
idea.
Correct. And so yeah, your first draft actually was a little more harsh than the more polite edited draft,
yes.
Which kind of evokes a conversation we had around the college, too.
We're really glad for your moderation, actually. I don't think it probably would have been as good if it ran the original way.
Well, and there were those of us in the college, and I've been guilty of this a couple times, you get farther with sugar than salt, and you don't make friends throwing bombs. And there are those in the college who disagree with me, which always makes for an interesting conversation. Yeah.
Sorry, something in my throat.
Say any names, but his initials are Professor Bruton.
PB.
No, it's an interesting role. So another thing you took issue with was that this person felt like SGA didn't really affect him And yet, you had an answer to that. What was your answer? A lot of numbers you're throwing around, too, which I love.
I threw around a lot of numbers, and I threw around a lot of roles that SGA plays. But my biggest concern is that he wrote a 1,300-word article.
Not an indication that this is not something you feel strongly about.
The man spent time writing that.
I think that was betrayed, exactly. Another important number in there starts with four. What was that
number? $4 million budget.
Some of it's your money. Some of it's tax money. Some of it comes from student services fees. But a lot of that money comes from students. That's the budget that student government is in charge of and brings in and disperses for various purposes over the course of a year. Student senators aren't paid for the job, so they're very careful with your, you know, the fiduciary responsibility of doling out your money. But another issue, you said if SGA doesn't matter, then maybe you should take another look at our budget, which touches on all kinds of things, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just the budget, the busing route is a huge part of that. That's the transportation fee that every student pays. And then your student services fees. I think SGA takes about 40% of that. And don't quote me on that. I know I'm on the air.
But a serious part of the budget is transportation.
Absolutely.
Paid for by students.
Over $3 million.
It's a, quote, free
bus. The budget
bus.
Is, yes. Yeah.
Professor Bruton, didn't I see you late on the S bus on Friday? My vision wasn't clear, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, we were a little hazy.
Okay, may not have been you. Okay,
yeah, but that's another great example of what SGA does and offers for students that, you know, apparently we don't affect anybody.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
No, this is interesting. So I guess, so journalistically, a point is be careful about the content of your journalism, even if it's editorials and opinions. First, accuracy still rules, and you have to take that very seriously. And then second, I've always been a fan as a journalist of going and talking to folks and asking some questions before I run with some stuff. And so I don't think that happened.
I think
that's
a great idea.
Okay. Because otherwise you'll get somebody who's an activist like Erica, who's happy to respond after the fact in as big and public a way as your original. And so be careful what you wish for, because you just might get it back in spades. It was interesting.
So article aside, you went ahead last Thursday. I was there, obviously, always. They can't get rid of me.
The final meeting of the school year.
That's right.
Yeah. You went on and you were supposed to, as a Senate, were supposed to confirm the results of the election. How did that go? I mean, obviously.
Sure. Obviously, you know, but
yeah,
let's discuss
I know.
It.
let's pretend like I don't.
We settled the final unsettled seat, I'm assuming, and that was the announcement at the...
Yes. So... as chairman of the Rules Administration Committee, it's my job to receive all the election results, present that to RNA and RNA Rules Administration, and we decide to approve those results, to not approve those results, or to not report. And basically, we then have to take those, whatever the committee votes, bring that to the Senate. And if it's approved, then the Senate gets the opportunity to approve as a whole, and all the elected officials then are basically approved, and we're saying, okay, this is good. This year, I mean, and that usually happens, no problem. RNA approves, Senate approves, those officials are good to go.
All very matter-of-fact, predictable.
Yes. And
this was a little bit different election this year.
This was. And honestly, it's not that different from most elections that happen. And so this year, with the, you know, all the different scandals that happened in the election,
the challenge, the
hearing, the Supreme Court case, all this, I didn't feel like as Rules and Administration that we had the power to say, yeah, okay, let's just go ahead and approve this, because we approve and we condone all the cheating that happened. We condone the outright exaggeration of things. The problems that were had with this and the scandal that it involved and confusion that it brought to the students.
And we may say allegations of cheating and the scandal.
We can say allegations, but I think we can also say that there was evidence proof for it.
Yeah, the Supreme Court did decide.
And the one apartment complex, the residents who received an email came to my inbox. I'm just saying.
Oh, really?
So, yeah.
Okay.
I thought that was very interesting.
You know, who knows who we reached during this election?
If you're not informed on this topic, very, very interesting topic. Great reporting by Anthony Hall here next to me on the TTUHub.net. Please go look it up.
Makes
very entertaining, informative reading.
It does.
Pretend like I'm important.
No, you are. And I've appreciated all you've done for SGA this year, you know, whether it puts
you're sweet.
Well, okay. Anyways. But so if we disapproved the election results. That looks extremely vindictive. You know, like we're targeting certain people, and that's not what we wanted to do. When RNA chose not to report on the election results,
our third option, just to not report.
What that was for us was a statement saying that, you know, we don't approve of how this election went down and how it was handled, and we want the students to know that. We don't think that this was properly serving the students. And so if we're going to have any legitimacy as a body next year, in the students' eyes and in administration's eyes, we can't say, yeah, okay, these are good, we're going to approve them. So,
in effect, sure. That decision, which is akin to a governor or a president allowing a law to become law without his signature. It's not a veto,
right.
It's not a signature, however.
It's by default.
But by doing that, it forwards to the Senate, and you're just still sharing the legislative responsibility with the entire body, right?
Yeah.
You're not destroying the results of the election. You're just passing it on to a wider body.
We're letting them stand, and based on the election code, if the results aren't acted on in 14 days, then they become official by default.
And yet, clearly, a statement made. So
that's what we wanted to do. Yeah.
So, with the default approval of the election results, the new executive start May 1st. Is that right?
You're going to kill me on dates here. I'm supposed to be the rules and administration chair.
Well, I mean,
those are things that
like,
I can go look at. But yeah, that's the idea: is that they will come in. We have our official banquet tomorrow night, and then but tonight is our first meeting with the new Senate, and we're hoping to do a transition tonight to give it kind of a symbolic thing and showing these new senators that come in that this is a serious deal and that they need to take their role with as much, you know, power as comes with it, that they need to be responsible with it.
And is that open to the public, that transition?
Absolutely.
Tonight? And when
yeah.
and where is that? Is that in the usual meeting room here in Media and Communication? No.
It's not.
Okay.
No, it's not. It's in the sub tonight.
Much easier to get a higher turnout in the sub.
Yes.
So, Anthony, about the dates and the locations, I think I can explain it. Senioritis. I'm just saying. So, I don't know. I could
I
be
mean,
wrong.
I have
senioritis.
I've had that since 2009.
Wait, Anthony, don't leave now. Come back. We still have a couple weeks of shows. Come
sorry.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, sorry on that, but I can get that to you guys.
No, later. It's fine. Folks can look it up. And again, if they have the
email somewhere,
if they have the initiative to be in the 14% of folks who vote, I'm sure they can look it up and go find their way to that meeting.
Absolutely, so, they can.
And that was a point you made very clearly that I want to emphasize again. If you're among the 86% who don't vote, or in a national or statewide election, upwards of 50%, shut up. Get to the polling place. Go to a voting booth and cast it. Get a chit in the game. Come on, it's ridiculous. Very valid point.
Real words of wisdom from Dr. Kelly Coffle.
Yeah, I've been voting in every election for a long, long time. I take it seriously and do my research and always have fun with it, and often yell at my polling machine, like, this is it? This is my only choice? So,
give me better results.
Well, I need Professor Bruton on the ballot, for crying out loud. That would ruffle some feathers. So,
we're trying to keep him awake over here.
We will get to him next. Erica, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. We're also grateful for your 4 years of service. And we may have an update on the location for tonight's meeting.
We do. It's at 4:30, and it actually is in the Media and Communication Room.
Okay, in the regular.
353.
Okay, yeah.
So
and that's
I was wrong about that.
That's a nice meeting room, and folks who are familiar with student government, they'll know right where it is. But yeah, it's in the third floor in the corner of the Media and Communication Building. Very nice facility. We often, in fact, are there plans to do that?
I am pretty sure.
Okay.
We are going to try to broadcast it live over the Raider 88.1. It can also stream online at ktxdfm.org. You know, tell all your friends, tell Facebook, because this is important.
All right. Erica, thank you so much for taking
thank
time
you.
To join us. We're going to take a break, and then we'll be back to talk journalism with Professor Pete Bruton here on The Devil's Advocate on 88.1.
I live my life like this.
Welcome back.
Welcome to Classic Rock on 88.1.
This is the official station of the 70s and 80s. Welcome back to the Devil's Advocate on KTXT, The Raider, 88.1 with Tony and Dr. K.
Hey, how are you? And Professor Pete Bruton joining us from the College of Media and Communication on the Faculty of Journalism and Electronic Media. Professor Bruton was the only one organized and ready. You would think Anthony and I would know.
Yeah, he was actually in here whooping us to get going.
Yeah, he's like, what's with this music? Come on, I'm ready to talk. So a change in policy, and it's kind of interesting, and I won't get into all of the theoretical implications from the egghead perspective, which is half of what
Nerd.
I do for a living, clearly. But the Associated Press is a huge, and I'll use the term, you might be familiar with it. The Associated Press is a huge agenda setter for the nation's media. A lot of things that run in the Associated Press get picked up in some of the remaining 1,300 daily newspapers.
Some of them.
Is it still 1,300, do you
think? Basically all of them.
I don't know. I'm looking at Professor Bruton. He looks skeptical. It used to be, it was about 1,330 a couple of years ago. It may be less than that now, sadly. However, AP runs in a lot of those. Another huge agenda setter is the New York Times, a lot of whose journalism gets picked up, cribbed, or copied, especially on the nightly network newscasts. Wait, did I say that? And so often those folks set agendas, set rules, set guidance for journalists all over the country. And so you're affected by the Associated Press, whether you know it or not. They made a change in policy this week. I thought it was kind of interesting. Anthony, what were you asking earlier? Was I in Lubbock County legally? Is that what you were asking?
Yeah, I mean, I had to make sure because I can't call you an illegal immigrant anymore.
I spent some time in the evil empire.
Yeah.
Professor Bruton, I think, was going to opine on this. It looked like he had something.
We checked his papers and everything. I mean, unfortunately, I cannot call Dr. K.
But papers from the evil empire make me illegal in this county, don't they?
Something like that. So people, this basically boils down to, and there's a big push of human rights, civil rights, whatever you want to call it.
Political correctness.
Yeah, there's a big political correctness push for this because people are not illegal. Valid or not.
The AP's change is they no longer want to use the term illegal immigrant to describe a person in their journalism, and they're going to cease doing it and recommending that others do it. We have a piece of audio that goes along a little bit with this, which should be a source for some entertainment value. Let's go ahead and listen to that, and then we'll...
Leon and Allison, folks over at the Associated Press say this is about labeling people, not their behavior, and they admit that this is probably not the end of this conversation.
It's called The Bible in the World of Print Journalists. The Associated Press style book sets rules, so what you read in newspapers is consistent. Journalists now being asked to stop calling certain people illegal immigrants. Instead, the AP says journalists should say a person is living or entering a country illegally or without legal permission. Their argument is the word illegal should describe an action, not a person.
It's very clearly the term illegal is meant to demonize and dehumanize an entire community of people.
I don't know that our journalism should reflect people's emotions. I think that these reporters should simply report the facts using legally correct terminology.
Now we hear the New York Times is considering making the same change in policy. Officials over at the Washington Post say since the AP made the policy change, they haven't talked about it. For now, they will continue to use the illegal immigrant term.
So now there's a divide between papers on what they're actually going to call people, whether it was... It reflects the crime or not, the crime of actually crossing the border. I mean, what else are you going to label these people as? I mean, there are legal immigrants and illegal immigrants. It's not a political correctness thing. It's actually a legal term.
Come on. The real divide is between the 99% of journalists who are liberals in the newsroom being politically correct and the absent 1% of journalists who are conservative, who work for maybe Fox News or National Review.
Yeah, the 1%.
Yeah, come on.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Okay.
Everybody knows what's going on. Professor Bruton joining us now because I'm speaking like a television news reporter. I always wonder why we don't use verbs in television news. I've wondered that myself. Any opinion on television news or on the
AP? We don't have enough time for my opinion on TV news. But the
Police
use of the present tense and the present participle is false. It's inaccurate. If anything happened in the past or someone said in the past, you use the past tense.
And by the way, AP style clearly dictates that, and it's correct. That's an excellent point. And so, yeah, why are we even listening to a television report on a policy about AP?
But going back to the question of illegal immigrants or aliens, that's even out too. I would go further than the AP. the question of whether something is illegal can only be decided and determined by a court of law.
By the way,
I'll remind journalist.
Folks, Professor Bruton, by the way, has a law degree. I should clear that up and let folks know. So
journalists have no business deciding whether something is illegal. Only courts can do that. And whether something is illegal can be a complex question of fact and law. And to make a conclusion that something is illegal without having a court look at the facts and the law is not good or right.
Well, this is interesting. It's kind of the progression from subject to suspect to convict in a court case, at which time your language you can use changes.
That's right.
Upon conviction, that guy's guilty as hell and you no longer have to hedge it. But
otherwise, you have to say alleged,
but until then,
or suspected.
I hate alleged. Never use that in your journalism. Always attribute it to somebody. It's just cleaner and better.
Right.
That's just my opinion, but okay.
Right.
Ouch.
It's a weasel. Alleged is a weasel word that we use too much.
Yeah. When you can easily say police telling us, I mean, you know, that's clearly.
Well, yeah, but that's throwing someone under the bus. Like,
it would be better to say police officer John Doe
told us. Yeah, thank you.
You've got a name. And
what was that about making more friends with sugar than salt? Like not making friends when throwing bombs? I mean.
Worked with a great public information officer at Miami Police, Bill Schwartz,
nice.
who used to come out and say, very entertaining, and the TV guys loved him because he'd come out and go, well, this dirtbag was hoping his gut would fit through the chimney, and he'd come out and give us those quotes. He was just brilliant. I just loved that guy. So,
let's talk about the law a little bit.
Okay, let's talk about the law a little bit.
It's not a crime to be in this country without proper documentation. It is a civil matter. It's not a criminal matter.
Interesting.
And I didn't know that.
Crossing the border without the proper documentation is a misdemeanor only. If you get deported and then come back, that's a felony.
Okay. So if there's a record of you having been caught and deported, now it's a second offense, and that's
right.
What makes it a felony?
That makes it a felony. But a large percentage of the people who are allegedly in this country illegally.
Hey, you can't say that. We just talked about that.
Okay.
Thank you.
The 12 to 20 million, depending on which right-wing media you watch. The
alleged by the media, a large percentage of that are people who entered this country legally. They had legal documents. They had visas, but the visas have expired. And now they are here without a proper visa.
I don't know how you misplace people in a country of 305 million people. I just don't know why.
Yeah, I mean, they all stick out like sore thumbs.
Yeah, how can you not just keep track of these folks?
I mean, we have this vision of, you know, of them hordes swimming across the Rio Grande. And when, in fact, many of them got here quite legally and have outstayed their visas.
Student visas, worker visas,
right.
Things like that.
That's
that's interesting. Interesting point. And I'll be alarmist and just remind folks the 15 Saudi hijackers on September 11th had all overstayed student visas and remained in the country illegally.
And thanks for that bit of yellow journalism.
They were among those. So that's just stating a fact. Depends on your news source. What's that? You're entitled to your opinion, but you're not entitled to your facts.
Yeah, basically.
Several times. So, yeah. So what do you think of the policy change? Do you think it's much ado about nothing, or do you think it's appropriate
I don't really care. I think that we need to get our facts straight first.
If a student uses illegal immigrant in an article in your reporting or advanced reporting class, what will happen to them?
I would probably circle it with a question mark.
But if it's properly attributed,
they're probably
okay.
How do you know this?
Okay.
How do you know this person is
skepticism.
In the country illegally? You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a question of fact.
Now, in reporting, you could ask them, and that might be a viable source. In advanced reporting, you'll need documentation for that article.
Sure.
I'm just pointing out the distinction between
very big difference.
Between his two courses. So,
right. If someone says it in a direct quote, sure, you're going to use it.
It's attributed, sure.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And so just like if they said illegal alien, you'd use that.
When you take his class or Professor Wernsman's, make sure you have attribution in every single paragraph. It's the best way to stay out of trouble.
John Doe said, Doe said, Doe said,
exactly.
Doe said.
Or said
That's
Doe.
What my news writing articles look like. Just line after line was someone said.
And
like,
I've had good...
No verb changes.
I've had good, stern editors. One of my favorite editors, and I won't call her out by name, one of my favorite bosses ever, who I magazine reported for. I used to love this, by the way. This is an aside. A meeting with this person went like this. Kelly, And I'd wheel around the corner and she'd go, here, work on this. And I'd grab the paper, salute, and leave. And that was the extent of a meeting. It was brilliant. And her thinking was, either you're good enough that I don't have to fire you, or you're gone and you're replaced.
That sounds like working at the Hub, actually.
Not a lot of intervention. You better do good work every day. And we got along just fine. I kind of enjoyed that. But what I would call prosecutorial editing, especially on complex pieces, business pieces, science pieces, and a question every sentence, is this correct? What's your source for this? What's your attribution? Do you have a second source for this? And it's actually a nice, safe way to practice journalism. The beauty of that is, even if there is something, God forbid, wrong in the article, now you're sharing the burden with the editor who pored through it with a fine-tooth comb. Of course, you don't want anything wrong in the article, and often that kept you out of trouble. But it's always nice to have an editor in your face, because then they have your back. And so, good way to practice. So yeah, this is interesting.
Yeah, I've noticed that the higher you go up the food chain, the more editors are more likely to not follow AP rules strictly. You know, it's for the little gnomes down working in the mines. And the Washington Post saying they're not going to. Well, you know, the Washington Post established a rule a long time ago.
The two source.
You know, you got to have two independent sources. Well, you know, did God tell them that? I mean,
Bradley told them that. It may as well have been God.
Why couldn't it be three or four? I mean, there's nothing, you know, sacrosanct about two. And many times I have found I thought I had two independent sources and I was really chasing my tail because both of them got it from someone else. And there was only one source.
Interesting.
So you've got to be very careful about, as long as you quote who said it, and so people will know and be able to judge, you know, its credibility.
Well, that's a great point. And that stemmed from Ben Bradley, had to be 1973 during the Watergate investigation.
Right.
And all he was trying to do was make sure they sort of invented the use of anonymous sources, which didn't exist before then. And of course, you talk about the importance of attribution, because then you as a reporter have clean hands. If you can't attribute the quote to somebody, that's a little scary. And especially back then it was. And so that's one of the reasons they instituted that. I mean, two was better than one, but great point. What if there are one source, and often was, Deep Throat. I forgot his name now, who passed away a couple of years ago.
Mark Felt.
Yeah, thank you. You know, he and
I love how you have that absolutely memorized.
I knew he would.
Like that.
I knew he would. Like, I'm older than him, so my memory's worse. That's the problem. So,
I don't think so.
He's skeptical of that.
Higher mileage, maybe? I don't know.
Another thing about attribution, and I tell this to my students, not only does it cover your butt, but your audience, it's something you do for the benefit of your audience so that they can better judge the credibility of whatever it is that you are reporting on.
Of your sources.
If you don't know who the source is, you really don't know much about it. In the law, a fact without a source is a nullity. It is ignored. It is treated as nothing. The source is everything.
And I've told people over the years, often the name might be important, but more often the title of your source is more important. And so that's an interesting element in journalism. I like the legal analogy. Very nice.
Yeah, like I really like that. So as journalists, should we more gear our writing towards that sort of, as Dr. K said, prosecutorial editing, writing with, you know, having support, logic, sources, everything for that, expert advice for our journalism,
yes,
like you would in a law case?
The problem becomes convincing your editor that you should do that. You should take the time to do it. You know, a lot of times your own deadline. I mean, a lot of times, most of the time, you're on a strict deadline and your editors are screaming at you.
Why am I going into this profession again?
And there's a pile of stuff in front of your editor at 7 o'clock in the evening and you're in line, and so...
Yeah. So you just have to convince them, look, this needs some more work. You know, we've got to talk to some more people. We've got to nail this down more. We've got to do some more reporting.
Well, your articles used to have to run through legal, too, at the Chronicle and Post in Houston.
All
am
of
I right?
Them.
Yeah.
All
so,
of them.
Really?
Yeah. The lawyers were the my ultimate editors.
Yep.
Wow.
You can lawyer up before or you can lawyer up after, and it's better to do it before.
Yeah.
When I would send my stories over, they say, send their stories over to the lawyers, I had a stamp that said based on a true story, and I'd stamp it the first page of it based on a true story.
That's awesome.
I like it. All right, so our tip for the day for freshmen, sophomore journalism students, if you're about to go into Professor Bruton's class or
study
if he's in your future,
law.
Yeah, study, no, don't study law, but
yes,
ready for some
law.
Prosecutorial editing in the class and a great, great learning experience. Professor Bruton, thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate your perspective. Since we're radical opinionated, you know, extremists on the show, we needed a neutral, objective.
It was very nice
source.
To get that. To control this animal over here. Like, you know.
To keep me on the chain. Thank you. We appreciate it.
No,
we
my
would
pleasure.
Would love to have you on the program more.
We've
hinted at it, and you've taunted us threatening, and so it was a lot of fun to finally get you in here.
We need to get Professor Wernsman down here, too.
Yeah,
we took
a swing at him,
day.
And he deferred to his fourth-floor neighbor, one of my neighbors, and so, yeah, we'll have to get him on here one time. Some fun stories.
Yes.
All right, well, we appreciate it. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back and talk about, you alluded to it a little bit, you're saying, why do I want to work in this profession?
Yeah.
We're going to talk about
it's a job.
Interesting new unemployment numbers that came out just late last week. So we'll talk to you in a couple minutes.
Harvard, nothing but bad luck. Since the day I saw the cat at my door.
Welcome back to The Devil's Advocate on KTXT, The Raider 88.1. Tony, still here with Dr. K after half an hour.
Because you can't find another job. That's what we're going to talk about
next. Well, I mean, one of these days, I'm going to get out of here, and I'm going to be famous, and be regretting that.
That's okay. Sorry. It'd be, come join me in the 1%, because yeah. I'm surprised I haven't heard from my wife at our tax appointment. I've been nervous this whole hour.
She's probably just doesn't want to, scare you, get on the phone and be like, oh, my God,
yeah,
all
exactly.
my money's gone.
Exactly.
Speaking of taxes.
Wait, one kudo I got to sneak in real quick before we get to taxes. And that is topical. I just have to thank our producer, Jason Kilhoffer, who's the best music DJ. And even though this isn't a music show, just loving the music.
What can I say? My man over there.
Loving the music.
Our maverick in the DJ, the control room.
Was paid
there.
For with your tax dollars before damn sequestration. Okay,
yeah.
I'll be your wingman anytime, all right?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, this is a Top Gun station.
We sure as hell wouldn't know what button to push, so thank God.
Yeah, so as he was saying, thanks Obama for the sequestration. You know, we can't pay our man anymore, so he volunteers. We have some new equipment, actually, as of this morning.
Yeah, new things installed this morning by General Manager Derek Ginter.
Derek Ginter, yeah, our engineer slash general manager slash technical director.
Jason was able to sort out the board, which was completely rewired and configured when he got in here, and still figured it out and got us on the air, so it was good.
Yeah, that's our man. So
Texas, you were saying something about Texas.
Texas and the sequester and Obama and... excuse me, and unemployment. I'm pretty sure we have a montage for all this.
We do. Let's roll that. Lots of voices.
Ladies and gentlemen, unemployment blues.
385,000 Americans filing for unemployment insurance. Yes, friends, the sequester is having an effect.
We are almost 4 years after the recession ended, and there are still, 86 cities that have fewer jobs than when the recession started.
My budget will make critical investments to grow the economy, create jobs, and strengthen the middle class. As I said in my State of the Union address, every day we should ask ourselves three questions. How do we make America a magnet for good jobs? How do we give our workers the skills they need to do those jobs? And how do we make sure that hard work leads to a decent living?
Obama inherited a less than robust economy, and Bush certainly contributed his share of spending and regulation to saddle the economy. But Obama has doubled down on those policies, so yes, I think he deserves a lot of blame.
It's a budget that doesn't spend beyond our means, and it's a budget that doesn't make harsh and unnecessary cuts that only serve to slow our economy. We'll keep our promise to an aging generation by shoring up Medicare, and we'll keep our promise to the next generation by investing in the fundamentals that have always made America strong: manufacturing, innovation, energy, and education.
We all overshot it. This is a punch to the gut. I mean, this is not a good number, and I think now you're going to, interestingly, start seeing a lot of discussion about maybe the sequester's a bigger deal than people thought it was.
You can see clothing stores, building material stores, these are all going down. There's problems here in the labor market for these industries, which are very directly tied to a payroll tax. But is that even going to matter? Because it seems like the White House is just going to say, this is sequestration. See, anything bad that happens now, no matter how disconnected it actually is sequestration.
We want to keep rebuilding this economy on a stronger, sturdier foundation for growth. Growth that creates good middle-class jobs. We have to make smarter choices. This week, I'll send a budget to Congress that will help do just that. A fiscally responsible blueprint for middle-class jobs and growth. For years, an argument in Washington has raged between reducing our deficits at all costs and making the investments we need to grow the economy. My budget puts that argument to rest.
One business cycle stands out for being by far the worst performance on jobs, and it's been under this administration.
Fewer self-inflicted wounds from Washington, like the across-the-board spending cuts that are already hurting many communities. Cuts that economists predict will cost our economy hundreds of thousands of jobs this year.
The reality is, more and more people are becoming unemployed because of the absolute crazed, insane austerity policies pushed on the American public by this narrow conservative Republican forces within the United States Congress.
Think about it this way. If you're a job creator out in America, the federal government right now is your enemy, and it's making it very difficult for you to do anything. And then, as I said, you have to look at both sides of the equation. You have all these government dependency programs that make sitting on your rear end more attractive than actually going out and getting a private sector job.
All right. So the theory of austerity is once again being put into action. Conservatives have told us if we just cut government spending, there will be so much confidence in the business community, people will spend more, invest more, the economy will grow. Well, this was proven wrong in Ireland and England and basically every country around the world has tried it. Now we started it a little more than a month ago, and we're starting to see the results. And the results are exactly as I predicted, exactly as Paul Krugman predicted it, exactly as every non-right-wing extremist economist has predicted. When you cut government spending in a time of flat growth, even recessionary times, you're going to make matters worse. You're going to shrink the economy and throw unemployment up higher. This is exactly what's happening, folks.
We had a great montage by our friend in the studio, Bianca Yarbrough.
Yeah,
right?
Thanks, Bianca. Very, very good.
So I think they talk more than we do.
Yeah, well, that was pretty long, but
it was good. Like, we needed all that. So,
you know, every few weeks you get new unemployment numbers. They come out monthly on a Friday, and it's a big deal on CNBC all day. And I always like to watch. And it says an unusually pitiful number.
Really, really sad.
They made it clear. And I love that punch to the gut analogy.
Yeah.
So that one's good. By the way, Austin Goolsbee was on the president's economic team, not some right-wing CNBC one percenter from Wall Street.
Right.
And he's the one who said it was a punch to the gut. So this is a former Clinton ally, still essentially an ally, just no longer in the White House. And he's the one that admitted these are really bad.
Somebody who you would expect to go, guys, not so bad.
Yeah,
so we got
exactly.
this under control. And he comes out
thing.
And says it hit us in the stomach.
No,
just boom, right in the gut. So before we do our coin toss and before I start railing on you about how wrong you are.
whichever side I'm on.
Right. Whichever one. Why don't you hit us with the facts?
Okay.
Like, what are our new unemployment numbers?
88,000 new jobs created.
Awesome.
Announced in February. No, that's actually awful because analysts expected between 170,000 and 200,000.
See, I was setting that up for
okay,
this appointment.
Nice,
so you
nice softball. I like that. A hanging curve. Love that.
Yeah. I was waiting for you, but I mean, I don't know.
Next time. Many, many economists will tell you need to create about 150,000 a month just to keep up with job shifting and population growth. And so this is half what we need just to maintain the proper employment. By the way, the unemployment rate stayed at 7.6%. That makes it a magic number.
That's good, right?
Yeah,
that's really good,
yeah,
right?
Do you know how that works?
No, why don't you explain it to me?
It's of people looking for work.
Pretend like I don't know.
Of people looking for work, 7.6% can't find their work. So the only reason that number can stay stagnant when the unemployment number is...
You're not saying that people stopped looking for work, are you?
A couple. Did you have a number we mentioned earlier? Do you remember how many people quit looking for work?
33,000?
10 times that.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. No,
330,000.
More than 300,000 quit looking for work, and only 88,000 got jobs. And so... So that's a hint.
Things are
a pretty bad month in the employment numbers. Let's take a break. We'll come back, play a little more sound, flip a coin, and we'll talk more about unemployment numbers. We'll try to do this in a way that doesn't depress you guys. But
we'll try.
But get your
Good
fiddle.
Luck.
You're going to need it.
Down to Georgia, he was looking for a soul to steal. He was in a bind because he was way behind and he was willing to make a deal. When he came across this young man sawing on a fiddle and playing it hot, and the devil jumped up on a hickory stump and said, "Boy, let me tell you what. I guess you didn't know it, but I'm a fiddle player too. And if you'd care to take a dare, I'll make a bet with you. Now you play pretty good fiddle, boy, but give the devil his due. I bet a fiddle of gold against your soul because I think I'm better than you." The boy said, "My name's Johnny, and it might be a sin, but I'll take your bet and you're going to regret, because I'm the best as ever been. Johnny, rosin up your bow and play your fiddle hard, because hell's broke loose in Georgia and the devil deals the cards. And if you win, you get this shiny fiddle made of gold, but if you lose, the devil gets your soul." Opened up his case and he said, "I'll start this show," and fire flew from his fingertips as he rosined up his bow, and he pulled the bow across the strings and it made a evil hiss, and then a band of demons joined in and it sounded something like this.
CNBC's Hampton Pearson joins us now from the department with the numbers, and a good number might help the market. Hampton.
Up 88,000. March non-farm payrolls increase by just 88,000 jobs, way below the consensus forecast for job growth of 200,000. Job losses, retail down 24,000. Trade, transportation, and utilities down by 27,000. The U.S. Postal Service shed 12,000 employees. The labor force participation rate in March came in at 63.3%. That's the lowest since May of 1979. The total labor force declined by 500,000. Total unemployment, as we speak, 11.7 million.
All right, let's
look at what happened to the future.
Nothing is ever.
We all overshot it. This is a punch to the gut. I mean, this is not a good number. And
I think now you're going to interestingly start seeing a lot of discussion about maybe the sequester's a bigger deal than people thought it was, because I think it's going to,
you know, not the sequester.
This is not
the sequester, but the payroll tax hike. That, I mean, it's massive decline in retail.
That almost sounded like a soundbite of us talking over one another.
Yeah, that was kind of fun.
Welcome back to the Devil's Advocate on KTXT The Raider 88.1. We snuck in a little soundbite for you right out of the break when Dr. K was teasing us about one of our, we were just talking about it, the punch to the gut.
Austin Goolsbee, former economic advisor to President Clinton. And then he immediately went into the reason for it. Let's do this. Let's flip a coin and we'll talk about the two excuses that are being blamed. And as usual, it's probably both at fault.
Yeah. Probably, so, but we can't say that because we got to pick a side. So yeah,
clearly, and we're good at that, and we like it. So I'll flip a coin. You call it. It's an American dollar coin again because it's the U.S. unemployment.
Talking about
rate.
America,
sorry. Exactly.
So I'm going to call it for heads for its taxes.
Okay, heads, you're going to blame taxes. Clearly, that's right. Heads, taxes. Okay.
All right, let's do this.
Okay, you're just wrong. It's the sequester, but you go first.
Whatever. Okay, so here's the problem. When you want to create jobs, you have to make sure that your tax policy reflects job creation. But the problem is that Obamacare, as well as the Medicaid payroll exemption tax, or withholding tax, sorry, the Social Security withholding tax, there, I got it that time, that everybody pays out of each paycheck in America, every paycheck now has a 6.2% tax attached to it that used to be only 4.2%. So 2% of your income is going to Social Security that was not before.
Is this the tax that's the only source for funding funding Social Security? That's the one you want to
get? Yeah, so you're so invested in this because you're going to be on it in less than like 5 years.
Ouch, I mean, the truth hurts.
At the way we're going. But so when businesses have to pay out this, don't they have to match it? They match this for Social Security.
Yeah, but exactly right. Theoretically, yeah. I know what you're going to say, though.
Yeah, so here it comes. Businesses are not going to want to shell out that extra 2% from their already staggeringly low profits. So
staggered, yeah.
Yeah,
ExxonMobil can't afford the extra 2%. Okay, fine.
Well, when you hire as many people and give as many important jobs as ExxonMobil does, now at the same time, in addition to this, what you might call reasonably small tax, there are now the Obamacare taxes. Thanks, Obama, where people are now having to either hire less people or give people expensive medical benefits, because otherwise you're going to get what they call a penalty.
Can I remind everybody which state has the most uninsured people, the most folks without health insurance? Do you remember which state that is?
That would be home sweet home right here in Texas. 26 million uninsured people.
Be right here in Texas. Well, around the country. But yeah, a whole bunch of them are right here in Texas. Exactly.
So. Right. So you railroaded me.
So you're clearly wrong, and actually it's the sequester, and everybody knows it's the sequester because you intransigent Republicans would not make a deal on a balanced approach and agree to raise a little bit more taxes by closing loopholes on millionaires so that
we gave you tax increases. Like, these are the tax increases that we're talking about.
Closing the loopholes was the Republicans' idea.
Oh,
and so the sequester has been ruinous. And there's a report in the Washington Post that says the sequester is going to cost 750,000 jobs. You heard Austin Goolsbee say it in that soundbite we played. Clearly, the sequester is a factor, and it's crippling a bunch of organizations who are now reluctant to hire. It's slowing the economy. And look, the payroll tax took effect the beginning of January. The sequester just took effect a few weeks ago. When did we get the horrible unemployment number? It was now. It was last Friday. That's the first number that was terrible. Job creation in January, February were actually up in the six-figure ranges. They were up in the 140,000, 150,000 range. But all of a sudden, the sequester takes effect and bam, out of jobs.
I don't think that's accurate. That doesn't sound. See, here is the problem. When you start blaming the sequester, you're blaming the result, not the source of the problem. The sequester was a huge problem because you kept pushing these more and more taxes on us that people cannot afford to pay when it comes to creating jobs and expanding business.
Okay, well, let me get some backup. Let me get the president to jump in here on my behalf.
Oh, yeah, because that's respectable backup.
Yeah, that's for crying out loud.
Now, yesterday we learned that our businesses created 95,000 new jobs last month. That's about 500,000 new jobs this year and nearly 6.5 million new jobs over the past 3 years. But we've got more to do to get the economy growing faster so that everybody who wants a job can find one. And that means we need fewer self-inflicted wounds from Washington, like the across-the-board spending cuts that are already hurting many communities. Cuts that economists predict will cost our economy hundreds of thousands of jobs this year.
A sharp increase in the number of Americans filing for unemployment last week. 385,000 Americans filing for unemployment insurance. Yes, friends, the sequester is having an effect. So the theory of austerity is once again being put into action. Conservatives have told us if we just cut government spending, there will be so much confidence in the business community, people will spend more, invest more, the economy will grow. Well, this was proven wrong in Ireland and England and basically every country around the world that's tried it. Now we started it a little more than a month ago, and we're starting to see the results. And the results are exactly as I predicted, exactly as Paul Krugman predicted it, exactly as every non-right-wing extremist economist has predicted. When you cut government spending in a time of flat growth, even recessionary times, you're going to make matters worse. You're going to shrink the economy and throw unemployment up higher. This is exactly what's happening, folks.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so that totally unbiased opinion is something that we're supposed to respect. Who was that?
How's that working?
Can you give me a name?
You know, I can't. I don't even remember his name.
There goes Pete Bruin's attribution. Okay. You don't even know who said this, so how can we trust it?
Fair enough, but he was in agreement with the president. And by the way, how's that austerity working for you in Cyprus, in Italy, in Ireland, in Greece?
Totally different. Totally different.
Because of the way 25% unemployment because of the draconian cuts. It's ridiculous. You have to, and Paul Krugman, we talked about this last week. Paul Krugman says a household budget is not the same as a government's budget. If nobody's spending, nobody works. It's bad for the economy.
Yeah, and nobody is spending, not because of the sequestration, but because of the taxes. Like I said, you're blaming the result and not the real issue. Now, you wanted backup. Now, I'm going to get some backup. Play my taxes soundbite, please.
Dan, very quickly, clarify for us, what's driving this number? Sequestration cuts that started March 1st, or the payroll tax went up for everybody starting January 1st?
The payroll tax increase was a lot bigger than the sequester. The sequester is just a tiny 1.2% of fiscal 2013 outlays, and we're still going to spend more in 2013 than we spent back in 2012. But it's not just the payroll tax increase. As part of his fiscal cliff, Obama was able to push up tax increases on small businesses and entrepreneurs and investors. And as a result of Obamacare, way back in 2010, we got a bunch of taxes on investment and capital beginning January 1st of this year.
A new report showing only 14 American cities have more jobs now than before the recession hit. But guess what? Nearly half of them are in the Lone Star State. That will be Texas, a state without an income tax. To Dan Mitchell, who says it's no coincidence that more jobs are going to low-tax Texas than other higher-tax places. Is that all there is to it? It's a tax preference move for jobs? Is that it?
Well, there's more than taxes, of course, for business location decisions. There's whether you're a right-to-work state, I suppose climate, transportation, education. But there's tons of evidence from academics over the years showing that there is a tendency for jobs to move from high-tax states to low-tax states, and Texas is being very smart by not having an income tax.
You see? Thank you. There it is. It's all about taxes. Now, I only got a couple minutes to destroy you with this.
Did you say it's all about Texas or taxes?
Both. Okay. It's all about Texas and their lack of taxes. So, really short on time. We're about to run out of the show. Only 1.2% of Americans were hit by the sequester.
We have 2 minutes left. That's more than you can fill with a logical argument.
Oh, please. Okay, so here it is. I'm going to hit you with it. 1.2% of the population was only hit by the sequester. Every single working class American and every single tax-paying business in this country was hit by the payroll tax increase and the Obamacare tax increases, as well as the penalties for not following the president's arbitrary rules on businesses.
Ouch.
Thank you.
That hurts. Okay. And sadly, there's some truth to it. So, all right.
All truth to it. I understand,
but clearly the sequester helped. And as I mentioned earlier, the Congressional Budget Office and some other nonpartisan entities have said up to 750,000 jobs will be attributed to the sequester. Now, as I've pointed out in the past, that'll be over 10 years or so. So, yeah, the sky isn't falling probably from either one of these things. And I don't
think we will recover next month.
Possibly. They will revise those numbers next month, so we'll see. Less than a minute left. We're out of time for this week. Thank you again, as always, for joining us for the Devil's Advocate here on Wednesday.
Yeah, and make sure you show up next week. We're going to have another great show. Tune in tomorrow for the Red Raider Rundown, and tune in Monday for Good Morning Texas Tech at 8 a.m., bright and early. We'll see you guys next week.